Are you listening? I was going to say, I was a long time ago since I read the book, and I was never quite sure between when she's living in the real world, which is a very realistic world, when she goes to Mother Posset, whether she's imagining that world. And also the second question, as I said, a long time, isn't there a scene in the end when she poisoned the doctor's... perhaps you could tell us, because I always thought that was very courageous, and I was very glad she did it.
Well, that's the other thing in the book that she did that she was proud of, apart from originally hitting the pimp, was that she managed to murder four of the doctors that were researching this new mind-controlling sort of technology. She does manage to kill them, which we don't know what happens after that, but presumably she probably gets lobotomized or something. It means the death of her, but she feels that, you know, that was a worthwhile thing to do. It's also, that is a fight, part of her fight, but the good future to win over the bad one. So in holding back that technology, I think there's something to do with that. But I don't know if it's in her imagination or not. It's science fiction.
No, I just wondered. I just wondered if it was supposed to exist, or whether she just sort of goes off into this fantasy world every now and again. Because the names of the people there are very Walt Disney-ish and things like that. I can't remember the names now.
Well, people name themselves, so they can choose names to suit their characters, and they're often quite Walt Disney-ish. I don't know. It's science fiction, and I don't know if it really exists or not. It's the idea.
That's okay.
It's
thank
sort
you.
Of a form.
Yeah. Just a vague attempt to answer the top of the front there. I've actually heard Aunt Tessie herself talking about the book. She is often quite ambiguous as to whether it really exists, whether it's fun of imagination. That's a state of affairs, anyway.
Any further points for discussion? Or questions you can get?
Oh, yeah, just the book, you mentioned there's two futures, a utopian and there's a nightmare future. What I got the impression from the book is that the two alternatives, the way present society is going towards, it very much depends on is Connie and other people in her situation, poor people, to struggle against the present system. That's why Connie is chosen by as a catcher by the utopian future. And that pressure gets that the utopian future depends on people in Connie's time and struggling, you know, struggling with the present system. She failed to do that, then you have a nightmare situation. She's feeling like present capitalist society, it's logical conclusion, mass pollution, strict hierarchy. Everything's run by multinationals. Second point is that really where she's introduced this utopian future by Lucienta, it's very much like, so I get the question, a bit like William Morris's Deuce of Nowhere. She's virtually as a guest and she asks questions based on prejudice, how you see the present society, they explain the new world. For example, when she sees kids running around, they're working on a farm. She says, why are they at school? So, they explain that education is part of life. This is similar to a passage in Deuce of Nowhere. I'm just wondering if she's actually influenced by William Morris' Deuce of Nowhere in this book.
Well, the first point there, there's a potential for both of those futures in today's society, and it is up to ordinary people like Connie and us to decide which one or what type of future we're going to have. I don't know if Marge Piercy was familiar with William Morris or not.
If anyone else would like to answer that? If anybody knows that? Anyone who's got any knowledge of Marge Piercy?
I thought the nightmare future, it reminded me of Brave New World. I don't know if it's familiar with Huxley. I probably won't, I'm sure.
There's a passage in the book that I thought did suggest that Marge Piercy knows, you know, the socialist argument very well. And that is where she deals with the idea that this utopia will do away with useless employment. There's quite a long passage in the book where she actually mentions the sorts of employments that you wouldn't have. That seems to me to come straight out of the socialist case. I was going to ask the same question, you know, does this suggest that Marge Piercy has in fact a good working knowledge of, you know, socialist theory?
She did read Morris's Deuce of Nowhere, and she mentioned it in writing about the book called On the Edge of Time.
Not very much we need to talk to you. And I'm a bit disturbed that there are big plugins that go around here. They still have to take their turn going away. And I think some sort of space is a very static bar. Very interesting. That would be very much brought out in the story. Why would it still happen? What were these other people wanting that they were trying to destroy the utopian society? Did you give them an idea?
Well, I assume that that future wanted to expand, you know, take as much as it possibly could. But I thought the fact that there was still fighting going on was all right. I mean, it fit into the book. I mean, it wasn't very pleasant.
I think what it is that the utopias are fighting the old ruling class who still got the power. So they haven't established full control of the planet and still fighting the old ruling class who still got control.
Because they live in such small scale villages, they don't really need the whole world. But which suggests that it's the other future that's trying to get into their territory.
Yeah. The old ruling class all trying to capture them. Come on.
What were they fighting with if they lived in these villages with no technology and the big boys had all the technology?
They did have technology, but they only used it in order to further their humanity, apart from in the water. But most of their enemies were actually these cyborgs, which were robots or sort of engineered humans. So they used to say a little pub in before they shot someone or whatever they did, to just in case they were human. So they care.
Then in the beginning of the book, I mean, I remember that the male violence was very strong there. It was quite frightening. Mm. And do you think that she thought that present society was the cause of male violence?
Well, I think it's not that clear. I think she sees male society dominated by male value as being part of property society. And I don't think she thinks that it's purely a product.
Yeah, one of the things about the book which you commented on is that the difference, the gender differences, they disappear, so that difference between men and women basically don't exist. In fact, nor between homosexuality and heterosexuality doesn't make any difference. But you seem to, at one point, be expressing some doubts as to whether you thought that was a desirable future. You know, maybe that men and women should be different or should stay different in some sort of way. I think this is an ambiguity in the whole feminist movement, isn't it? I mean, what is meant by equality? Is it equal but different, or is everybody going to be the same? And I think I would agree with the author of the book that the tendency would be for all of us to become more and more alike as human beings. But I mentioned that in that quote.
Yeah, I know what you're
anthropologists are talking about as well.
Yeah.
What it's like in the body.
No, I didn't mean to say that. I know I said something in the wrong order.
Oh.
But, no, I think the desirable thing is less polarity, certainly. What did you say about the feminist?
No, I mean, the feminist movement itself seems to be ambiguous on this position, because there are some that do see the future as, you know, we have a separate women and separate men, whereas I would have thought, you know, but not just a socialist view of the future, but you know, a humanist view of the future would be that we all tend to become you know, more the same as human beings, as you were pointing out, you know, other quotes from the anthropologists.
The book, it did strike me, because I thought about this, that in the utopia, it wasn't so much that men and women had come together into a middle bit, but that everyone had sort of become like women. I didn't want to say that. I think that's what had happened. I think we can talk about a male culture and a female culture in this society.
Yeah.
And I think they are different, and I think the female culture is more conducive to the sort of future that is socialist and that is humane. But whether that means that men are
going to
become like women, I don't know.
Well, men are not going to stay like men out there, I'm sure.
If I could follow that and digress slightly, in Herland, a book that I've not read, but which is dealt with in this month's Social Standard by Karina Mervin, procreation apparently can take place just by willing it. And what puzzled me just crudely is, since nobody here believes in a virgin birth, although I haven't read the book, I mean, how any utopia's got to have a certain amount of credibility within its system, and that struck me as somewhat incredible. I don't know if Karina could enlighten me a bit, she's sitting there.
What?
The idea of procreation without sex taking place.
It already happens, doesn't it? It's already got that technology.
It does in worms, but I don't think it does in humans.
Do you want
to
comment on that?
Well, I can't really speak for the author but I think what the point she's trying to make in her life is that people can have children without necessarily having a woman to have children without necessarily having a relationship with a man. And that was actually possible in her life. There are plenty of lesbian mothers who have children, they may or may not choose to continue some kind of friendship or relationship with the man who donates the sperm. Sometimes they don't even know the man who donates the sperm.
But you do need sperm, Colin.
Well, yeah, but we're talking about a fantasy novel.
Right.
That actually, nowadays, we could actually say, well, this is possible.
For most of human history, again, the connection between sperm and pregnancy wasn't known or realised. And it was considered a women's magic that they gave birth, and children were really belonged to their mothers. That was it. There's only sort of coincided with the realisation of the role of fertilisation that came a lot of the other, like the competitive society and the patriarchal society came at much the same time as that. But it's not always been given that you need a man and a woman to have children.
Or that you need to
in this book. I mean, in this book, Women on Edge of Time, each child gets three mothers, and they put in for motherhood, they like put their name down. And it's not biological parenthood means nothing.
Yeah, the man can be a mother as well, can't
he? Yeah. Exactly the same role.
But, sorry, was it the children who got three mothers?
Yeah.
They've got their names now, like Eta. So you can have these mothers, you put your name down. Sort of 20 years before.
No, the mothers, the people put their names down to the next baby, or when the baby comes in.
That was children were born indiscriminately. They were born, had one person died, another was allowed to be born. Was that true?
Yeah, and that was done in the name of population control.
Also, in Mattapoisett, wasn't there a use of language? They didn't have the feminine and masculine pronoun. There was a sort of neuter sort of a metaphor.
Yeah, they reformed the pronouns, so they were no longer gender specific, which I think I liked that. I hope we'd be moving in that direction.
Yeah, but I don't know how you tell the men from the women then.
Well, it doesn't matter.
It might not be true.
I think it's. I remember reading this book quite some time ago, and when I heard about this talk, I got the book out of the library again. And as soon as I read the first line, I realised I'd read it before. But I must say, the middle bit escaped me until I had another look at it. I do think it's a thorough condemnation of capitalism, of poverty and inhumanity, of man to man and men to women, and people with authority to. Powerless people. And in that sense, it's a very good book and a very good analysis of those things. It's also an extremely depressing book. And although that middle bit about the utopian bit may give people fantastic ideas, I mean, it's not that I wouldn't agree with it, I wouldn't agree with some of the stuff that's been said about gender and ironing out the differences between male and female. I don't think, not to me, that's not a
future rather than just see. But, of course, ironing out differences that exist partly because of the nature of society we're in today. Yes, of course.
But I think one thing that's lacking in this book, and that is any kind of lead as to how the society can move towards an improvement and a different kind of way of life. And in fact, of course, this book ends up very depressingly reeling off Connie's psychiatric history. And I wonder whether you have any comments about what I consider a lack in that book of how to progress.
The progression that took place in the book was a 30 years of war, which is a, you know, a violent war, which obviously must have done the earth a lot of damage and took a lot of putting right again. But I think it doesn't say much specific about it. It says that poor people did rise up and, you know, said we're not going to take it anymore. And I think Connie's supposed to be a microcosm of that for poor people, in that she does. She does at least learn to have confidence in herself and believe in what she experiences are real. How she feels about it is real. But I think that it's in the tradition of sort of individuals must gain confidence and think themselves worthy of a better world. But I don't think it sets out to do anything more specific than that. But it probably isn't that.
It's not really a very political
one. I think it's very good that it does show her as a character. You can really believe it, that she's right.
She's in Catch 22. Further points? Yes.
There is a theme that runs through utopian writing right away from the start, it seems to me, and that is the idea of madness. It's almost kind of, people may well ask, what is the transition to a utopian society? And we tend to think of transitions in terms of time, or some people, if they're very unimaginative and dull, then think of it in terms of government, you know, transitional government. But in a sense, you know, there is an argument for saying that people do have to go slightly mad before we can have sanity, and madness. It's got a bit, the notion of madness has got to be challenged. I mean, madness is perhaps one of the key dominating ideological forces a capitalist society has always had for those people who are regarded as a danger to it. And the classification mad means, usually, somebody who sees a future which is unacceptable, as it happens in classical thinking. The word madman and the word prophet is identical, it's the same word, and even going back to early hieroglyphics, there are actually cave drawings of prophets where there are pictures of people having what now would be usually seen as some sort of epileptic seizure. If you read about Isaiah, who was one of the most radical prophets of the Old Testament, most of the descriptions of him, foaming from the mouth and so on, talking about the future, are of a kind of madness. And if you look at utopian writing then, you also find in utopia people always saying to the person from another society, this person must be mad. I mean, for example, you talk about William Morris and Route to Nowhere. Now, when William Guest, who was a visitor to News from Nowhere, arrives in News from Nowhere, and he meets the guy who recognises that a moneyless society possibility, he's living in a moneyless society, he doesn't know what money is. William Guest, and it's recorded in the first chapter, I think, or second book, he says, I thought this man might be a lunatic who escaped from Coney Hatch, which is a famous 19th century asylum for the insane. But he said, well, I thought I'll humour him for a while, you know, with his idea of a moneyless society. And if he subsequently turns out to be a lunatic, I'll shake him off. Now, that's the actual, I'm not quoting word for word, but almost word for word, what William Morris says in the mouth of his person. I could give you lots of other examples, I won't give you lots of other examples, but from all the good utopias, madness played a role. The idea of people being strange, and never Erewhon by Butler, Samuel Butler. They when he climbs over a mountain range to get to the utopia there, and when he finally meets with the people in his utopia, they say to him, "You must have fallen down while you were climbing over the mountain, and you hit over the head by a rock." Because he said, in order to try and understand whether they are real people, he asks them to name various things. He says, "Have you heard of Bismarck? Have you heard of, I think, Randolph Churchill?" You know, he gives a whole list of names, you see, in battles. They've never heard of it. So he thinks they're mad, they think he's mad. And this whole kind of dialogue of madness is actually a key revolutionary issue in mind. It is a matter that we have got to confront. I mean, if you think about it, put yourself in a position of a person walking past this building on a Sunday afternoon, some of them having gone to church in the morning, incidentally, and talked up at a group to a God who they imagined was there, quite happily. That's perfectly sane. In fact, the House of Commons, before it meets every day, does precisely the same thing, just to prove how sane they are. And they look through the window and they see us. Now, we're a pretty peculiar-looking bunch, aren't we? I mean, never mind about men looking like women and women looking like men. Most of us don't look like we ought to be on the outside on our own. Because the reason is thinking. I mean, when you do a certain amount of thinking in society, it does seem to have a sort of an effect. I think there are always two things you can tell on a person's face. One, whether they've worked too hard. I mean, most people, for me, work too hard. I look at them and their face, and their faces show the sun. Most people's foreheads are creased up by overwork, attention. Work is very bad. You shouldn't be working more than 2 or 3 hours a day, and people who do normally look bad as a result of it. You should be having a sleep and enjoying yourself and talking to people and so on. Right. And the other thing is, you can always tell people who think a lot. Because there's a certain what? I mean, put it this way, you can tell people who never think. You can tell people who don't seem to think very much. Because you see, I mean, some of them have a special certificate they walk around carrying called the Sun. And you can see them on the other hand. You know, this is a person, obviously, who is, you know, they try to suppress the fundamental characteristic of human nature, which is to think intelligently, to plan, to memorise, to imagine, and clearly they're trying to sort of tranquilise themselves in that situation. Now, we are not those sort of people in a room like this. We are slightly balmy, aren't we? Because we are sitting here talking about, first of all, a future that somebody has imagined for us. We share in her imagination. That itself is a kind of madness, you know. Secondly, we have our own ideas of the future. We want to bring about that future. We think it's meaningful. We think we can do it. We think we can change history. We think we're more important than Bill Clinton. We think Bill Clinton's advisors are mad, even though we're told that they are the people who are going to govern the future of the world. So there is this tension. One of us is mad, either us or them. Because when I watch the news, I am forced constantly into that conclusion. Either they're mad or I'm mad. There's no compromise. We can't both be sane, because what they're saying, as far as I'm concerned, are the gibbering of a lunatic. Now, I might tell you another book that's very similar to Woman on the Edge of Time, Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed. And in The Dispossessed, the person is going from the anarchist planet, or the socialist planet, or let's call it the anarcho-socialist planet, Anaris, to the other one, which is like America, called Eurax. When they get there, they read an economics book. And in the actual text, it says, because I've gone through all these utopias, crossing, underlining, where they represent the madness, which I find quite interesting. And in that particular book, this person reads an economics book and says, this seems to be like the babbling of a lunatic written by someone with no relationship to reality. Well, that's true, isn't it? Now, clearly, someone's saying someone's mad. I mean, you can't, let's not be liberal about this. Let's not say, oh, well, it's only my opinion, either I'm right or they're right. I mean, that's not the way it is. You can say that about whether you like, you know, the paintings of Picasso. I can look at them and I can say, it looks to me like a load of bloody squiggles. And someone else says, no, this is profound. And say, okay, well, that's your opinion, that's mine. I'll try and inform myself of your view. You try and inform yourself of my view. When I hear a professor at the London School of Economics saying, we can't live without money, so on, so forth, I look at him and I say, look, this person is a bloody lunatic. In fact, a dangerous lunatic. A very, very dangerous lunatic. And under the Mental Health Act, there is a saying, anyone who is a danger to themselves or other people should be locked up. Now, unfortunately, it's us who get locked up, not them. And I'd like to suggest on this issue of madness, because I know, you know, that the woman who is the centre of this novel is regarded mad. I'd like to just relate the point, and because I think one of the points about the novel is that we are meant to talk about our own life. I mean, it talks very intimately about life. Now, when I was a kid at school, I was declared to be mad to the extent that they sent me to see a psychiatrist. And the reason was that I wouldn't go. I refused to attend on the grounds that I didn't think they had anything to teach me, and I thought I was cleverer than the teachers. I still think I was cleverer than the teachers. I'm quite certain of it. Eventually, one day, they called me into this office and said, we want you to go and see a psychiatrist. My parents objected, because they thought it would be a stigma later in life. They didn't know that I would subsequently be boasting about it in a public meeting. But they said, we want you to go and see a psychiatrist. And I went to see this guy on the grounds that it gave me a half a day off and I could go and have a chat with someone who I thought might have something. First of all, if I could just relate the experience, it didn't inspire any great confidence to see the guy was wearing a crucifix around his neck when I went in to see him. So for a start, I didn't exactly think, well, this guy's going to have anything to, this guy's going to help me very much, you know. Perhaps he thought it was going to protect him against the people he had to see. But I also noticed that as soon as I sat down, this person looked at me as if I was mad. You know, even though I was quite a lot younger than he was at the time, he talked to me as if I was at his farm as well. And within about half an hour, I convinced him that I was sufficiently rational not to kill anyone and to probably go on subsequently and get a job. And I actually subsequently went on, I got a good job. And I succeeded in capitalist society to be sufficiently mad and at the same time employable. So I'm not worried about it. But there are a lot of people who are regarded as mad and no one will employ them. There are a lot of people, one or two of them in this room, who are officially designated as being mad. There are others of us who are constantly on the borderline. There are some of you who will become on the borderline if you educate yourself a bit more. Some of you who are dangerously far from the line. And it does seem to me that that is an issue we need to be talking about. When people talk about the transition period, to me, and I like your view on it, and I thought it was extremely...